Good morning, folks. Hope you're having a great Friday morning. What a hot week it's been this week, for sure. Hopefully next week will be a little cooler. Looks like we're going to have some rain possibly this afternoon through the weekend, and maybe it'll cool things down. We've got a great lineup for you today. Professor Charles Baird, Professor of Economics Emeritus at the California State University, East Bay. He did a study with Cato, arguing that the labor laws of the 1930s are deeply flawed. They damage the economy and violate individual rights, particularly the freedom of association. He goes on to say that these laws don't really align with the way that business, the economy is structured today. And we'll talk about some of the examples of where it has actually stifled and stymied wage growth for their members and things of that nature. At noon, Becky Mowbray, president and CEO of BGR, Bureau of Governmental Research, she forwarded a couple of documents to me about potential questions to be asked of candidates. You've heard me say a number of times, get involved, listen to the candidates, listen to what they're saying to gain a better understanding about who they are and alike. As I read through the questions that they were proposing, and they're sending them to the candidates, I wanted to spend some time having you hear the questions, so that if you come in contact with a candidate, or you're at a forum or others, and you have an opportunity to ask questions, you may want to ask one of these questions. Very well done. They put a lot of thought into this, so we'll visit with Becky at noon. J.P. Morrell joins us at 11:30, New Orleans City Council member at large, and he's the president of the council. And, you guessed it, we're going to be talking garbage, trying to figure out who's on first, what's on second, where we're headed, how this ultimately all plays out. Sounds like the mayor did the right thing yesterday. We'll get a better understanding of that. Freddie King joins us. He's a New Orleans City Council member at 11, and he's going to talk to us about these ABO licenses and the renewals here in the city. The city council took some measures back in the spring of this year in hopes of helping the ABO outlets. Not sure whether or not the administration adhered to some of that or not. We'll gain a better understanding, and we'll talk about how can we make sure that this is easier for these restaurants with Freddie King. A lot going on in the Middle East, right? And it seems as though the tone and tenor from some major countries promoting this two-state solution in an attempt to turn public sentiment against Israel. I'm not so sure it's pro-Hamas, but it looks that way, as though people are thinking that Hamas is going to continue to govern Gaza. Well, we'll find out from Colonel Alex Gann, what are the people in Israel thinking? And are they aware of this shift and how this makes a lot of what's going on more difficult? It makes the value of the hostages go up as Hamas will continue to leverage the remaining hostages and the like. This is not getting any better. It's not getting any easier. There's a whole lot of misinformation that's been put out about a whole bunch of things. We can go through that history. I mean, Hamas is a master of trying to manipulate the media and creating these hoaxes of the Gazan war. And the media just takes it hook, line, and sinker and just goes running with it. The UN is engaged in the same thing. And what happens is all this misinformation leads to confusion, and nobody even really knows anywhere what's near the truth. Well, anytime you're in the middle of war, things, I believe, tend to be more complicated, right? It seems as though many people are trying to make it very simplistic. Wanted to talk about a couple of things this morning. We spend a lot of time on this show talking about education. And education in lower school, middle school, high school, leading into college, advanced degrees, the financing of same. We've talked about student loans. We've talked about the inability of these processing agencies to keep students on top of where they are, how big of a hole are they in at the present time. Maybe they can be paying off some of the interest. That's not what they really want. They like to have that interest just keep compounding, you know, on these loans and so forth. You can't dispense of them in bankruptcies and things of that nature. But there's a whole different component and dynamic to what's going on. And it has to do with international students. And a lot of folks, someone was asking me the other day, why is the administration so attuned to these student visas and international students? Well, there's been a couple of articles that have been done on the breadth and depth of what's actually happening with foreign student visas and the way that how they're charged, how much tuition they pay, and in a lot of cases, they're paying cold, hard cash to visit here. Some are sponsored by their country and otherwise. And there's also a belief, especially with Chinese students, that there's this possibility that they may be here on behalf of the government as the eyes and ears of the government. And it, depending on where they're working and what research they're doing as to whether or not, and there have been students caught with stealing this research and bringing it back to China. I suspect that that's not that many. But there seems to be a bigger problem. And that is, who is actually making up the lion's share of graduate students now in the highest performing universities that we have in our country? There was an article that was written that talked about the, you know, the character of these American institutions is really changing. And they believe it's directly related to the breadth and depth of the numbers of international students that are being brought into this country. Over 1.1 million student visas every year. In fact, the 2023-2024 academic year, the U.S. hosted 1.1 million international students, a 7% increase from the prior year. Nearly half of that 1.1 million were graduate students, 500,000 plus. International grad school enrollments grew by 10.2% from 2021 to 2022, and American enrollments dropped 4.7%. And in some fields, it's even worse, in some disciplines. So take STEM, for example. In the STEM-related fields, international student enrollment grew by 100% since the pandemic. At Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government, the percentage of international students rose from 56% in 2023 to 59% in 2024. So in that program, they are actually the majority. At Carnegie Mellon, Cornell, Johns Hopkins, Columbia, and others, international students make up 48% or more of the graduate student body. At MIT, it's 42%. And what they found in their analysis of looking at this data over a period of time is that once the international student population surpasses about a 13% level, they found this weird happening that campus protests doubled on these respective campuses as opposed to their peers that stayed below that 13% level. It's really causing some significant consternation as to whether the culture of advanced education in this country is eroding in a way that we're not serving the best interest of Americans. And I can't disagree. We don't need disruptive campuses. We need campuses to be stable, to be solid, to be sacrosanct. Why we would want to have to listen to an international student about our politics, about what we do with foreign policy or otherwise, they're an invited guest. I don't remember the invitation going out that we wanted to hear what they had to say. And I feel really strongly about this. Because a lot of your tax dollars are going to these universities for the purposes of research that we're utilizing these students who now in many of these universities are the majority in advanced education. They get all the benefit. 3 in 10 international students apply for a green card and 70% go back home. I'm not so sure that that's a great ROI for us, a return on our investment. If we have to be burdened with all this other shenanigans that are going on, that are wreaking havoc on our campuses across this country. But bigger than that is, what happens to the students that are trying, American students, that are trying to get in these master programs of these high-performing universities? Well, don't be surprised. The opportunities for minorities, for example, become extremely limited. At Harvard's Kennedy School, a 50% drop in Black or African-American enrollment in 2023 compared to 2021. At the same time, international enrollment went up. And in addition, multiple scholarship opportunities at publicly funded colleges are open only to illegal immigrant students, excluding those to applicants who are American born. Would you like me to say that again? I had to read it 3 times. We have lost our mind. In fact, a group of organizations that are serving as plaintiffs in lawsuits who have not yet lost a lawsuit attacking these types of arrangements have all been ruled unconstitutional. But this is what's been going on. And this is why the International Student Visa Program needs to be rehabilitated. Needs to serve the best interests of this country, not anyone else. And we need to make sure that we are serving our own. And again, I don't apologize about saying America first. If our taxpayer dollars are going to be funding and financing research, student loans, and everything else for these high-performing universities in this country, the majority of the enrollees in advanced educational opportunities on those campuses ought to be reserved for Americans. And I can't believe they're not. But this is the path that we're going down. And now we're beginning, as we peel back the layers of the onion, we're beginning to understand why we're seeing this level of deflection, denial, evasion, counterattacks, disruption on our college campuses. Because in many respects, these international students come from places that don't like America. They don't like us. They don't like our way of life. They don't like our thought process. They are not in favor of a constitutional republic or a democracy. They would much rather advance communism, socialism, or otherwise. Why would we bring these people to this country to educate them? Why would we not focus on our allies? and work out an arrangement there as opposed to helping our enemy. It doesn't make any sense, especially when we're punishing our own. We're punishing our own. We talk about how few people are willing to go into STEM, and maybe, just maybe, in large measure, it could be, it's really hard to get into these STEM programs. Because there was obviously 100% increase in there for international students, and over 50% of the enrollees are not Americans. They're not U.S. born. And only 3 in 10 stay in the country, and all the rest go back to their origin country. I can't imagine for the life of me the plus-plus, the win-win of that arrangement, other than financially for the university. And meanwhile, they take your tax dollars. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We check in periodically with Colonel Alex Gann, retired colonel and fighter pilot for the Israeli Air Force, now living in a small village in northern Israel. Colonel, welcome to the show.
Thank you, and good evening or good afternoon to you.
Colonel, I hope you guys are doing well. If you would just briefly tell us the state of the state as you see it right now.
Wow. It's kind of chaotic. I'll put it this way. We have kind of a gridlock on the Gaza situation, and I think it's dividing the country, and most of the people, most of the population is for ending the war immediately, returning the hostages, and then dealing with whatever comes after that. The government, who is very right-winged, is actually controlling Netanyahu, has the influence of the government, and they're against it, and this is causing a huge chaos around Gaza. We had a big crisis regarding the food supplies. A lot of it was based on fake pictures, but it doesn't matter. Once this is in the media, and once this is the edifix of the people, then it doesn't matter what you say. This is a very bad situation. And I think it's about time we get over with this whole thing. So it's very problematic. And the most important thing here is now getting the hostages back. It's enough. It's 665 days, and that's way too much. We just had pictures released yesterday of two of the hostages. They are really, really holding to their lives on a very thin thread.
So how does this change, though? I mean, you know, the reality and what's being talked about here in the United States is that the reality is Hamas really is fighting for their identity. They want to be involved in governing Gaza still. The only leverage they have are these hostages. Obviously, the U.S. and Bibi Netanyahu are not in favor of Hamas having any role in the governance of Gaza. So we're kind of gridlock.
No one is in favor of Hamas. Not even the Arab countries around us.
Right.
They know that they're extremists, and they're a danger to everywhere. They're like a kind of a virus, which everywhere they go, they cause chaos and death. So no one wants them to rule Gaza again. It's a very difficult issue, but we have to put someone instead of them. And this is something which neither us nor the U.S. nor anyone else was willing to take control of Gaza instead of Hamas. And when you have this kind of void of governing, then it's chaos. And it was part of our responsibility as a government to take care of this issue and find some identity, maybe even the Palestinian Authority, which no one really likes either. But it's someone that you can talk to and deal with and get someone to rule Gaza on the civilian side. Hamas is not willing also to put their weapon down. And I think we should get with them to kind of some kind of a deal which is close to what we have in Lebanon with Hezbollah. But we have to, we are the stronger side, I would say, military-wise. But today, I think we are on the weaker side, the politically side. You can see now this kind of tsunami with all the countries over the world. Everyone wants to have, to give them a Palestinian state. A Palestinian state to whom? To Hamas, as a kind of a prize for what they did on October 7th. It's complicated. And that's
yeah, I mean, that's where I was going to go next, because, you know, Hamas has been guilty of perpetuating one hoax after the next, right? I mean, we can, you and I have talked about it almost every time. They put these images out. They put this information out. It's not anywhere near the truth. They've continued to do so. Mainstream media in the U.S., in France, in Britain, they've gobbled this up as though it's an absolute truth. And almost every time it's been debunked and showed that it's not anywhere near the truth. They try to make this a very simplistic equation. The complicity of this is second to none. And now, you know, as we get nearer and nearer to what we think could be the end, their support of a two-state solution, making these announcements and these demands on Israel at this point in time, empowers Hamas. And it's not going to encourage Hamas to release these hostages. They're making this situation even worse because they want to satisfy their own. They're not popular in their home country. So they're going to endear themselves to the Palestinians that are in their country by talking about these silly propositions that everyone knows it ain't going to happen. It's not happening. There's not going to be a two-state solution, and Hamas is not going to govern it, right?
Yeah, of course. But, you know, again, the problem with the world today is the truth doesn't matter. What's in the people's head and in the media and on Facebook or Instagram or whatever, that's the truth. And when people look at that, so now I'm sure also all these rallies all over the world of the poor Palestinians are actually backed up by Qatar and Iran money. We know that. And the governments, you know, they're very, you could see it in the statement which the Prime Minister of the UK, where he had to make his statement, you know, after the President of France did it for mostly internal considerations.
Sure.
But once it's out there, what can we do? And then all the countries are run after them. And when you ask him one simple question, okay, what is your suggestion? What should Israel do now? Give us not only what not to do, tell us what yes to do. No one has an answer to that. And that's the main, it's a kind of a catch-22 issue. And we have to break this gridlock. And every day that we hesitate, it's more complicated, because now Hamas, what you just yesterday said, okay, I'm not going back even to negotiations until there's enough food for everybody, because he grabs the food and sells it. He makes a lot of money. So what are we going to do about that? You know. So
And meanwhile, the UN is insisting that Hamas be the deliverer of the aid, because
the UN insists that it will be the delivering of the aid, the UN. But when we show that there are 900 trucks and thousands of tons of food waiting for the UN to get them into Gaza, and they don't do it because they don't have the logistics to back it, so again we're to blame. But what can we do about it? Because the UN knows, because the UN collaborates with Hamas. Many people in Hamas, we used to be UN workers, and the UN is trying to, you know, to hide it. But again, it's so complicated, and again, we're like we're in the mud, and every time in quicksand, every movement you sink deeper. And we have to have to break this gridlock. With I think there's no choice with one big move, get this whole thing over, whatever the cost would be, and then we can deal with Hamas. That's personally, I think that's
so. What is the prevailing thought right now in Israel? So everybody recognizes this political, you know, foreign policy game that's being played by these leaders that are complicating this equation.
Their thought is, you know, they go always to this very simple saying, you're anti-Semitic, et cetera, et cetera. It's not from there. The problem is that this government is such a bad government. We have never had such a really bad, low-managed, and terrible government. And they don't want to go to elections because they know once there are elections, they're out of a job, most of them. So they're sticking and gluing their ass to the seat and refusing to everything. And actually, I would say a lot of the blame is on our government. In our government, most likely, it's Bibi Netanyahu, because he doesn't stand up against the right-wing ministers who are refusing to any compromise, who want to conquer back Gaza, who want to settle back again in Gaza, which is a really a terrible idea. And it won't be simple, you know. When everybody, I'm considered to be the optimistic thinker, and many people come to ask me what will happen. I say, you know, at the end, we are a strong nation. We'll build up, but every day when we go down the hill, it will take us a week to go up. So if it's 600 days down, it will take us 600 weeks to climb, which means we have 10 or 12 years ahead of us of hard labor in building up the country. Maybe we'll do it faster than that. Because it's surprisingly that the economy is doing fairly well. And for instance,
but as it relates to Gaza, is there a mindset that history tends to repeat itself? Israel got out of Gaza, gave it, you know, the Palestinians were in control. They decided, you know, one way or the other, whether reluctantly or they were forced to or whatever, to turn it over to Hamas. You know, and when you have undercurrent is that that you know, we want to kill Jews, whether you're a member of Hamas or you're a member of the Palestinian population. How do you deal with that? I mean, that's the thing I can't square up in my head.
That's Gaza has been, I would say, a thorn in the country since 2,000 years ago. There have always been conflicts with Gaza. And when we left Gaza, it wasn't the first time we left Gaza. We conquered part of Gaza in 48 and then in 56 and then in 67. And when we gave it back in 1980, the Anwar Sadat, the president of Egypt, knew very well why he didn't want Gaza back. He said, no, thank you. I know who these people are. Leave them on their own. And it's a problem, you know, but many, many people in Gaza worked in Israel and we had good relations with them and we're hoping to build a future together. But the extremists, Hamas, when they took over in 2006 with violence and shooting all over, everybody is afraid of them. They control the country and they you know, when you see you read the books, which they educate the kids, you understand where Gaza is going. It's a very sad story. Now Gaza today, it looks like Hiroshima. Really, there's nothing to build Gaza back. It will be very costly. What I think it's part of building Gaza back is part of the whole process. Once we make a deal with them, once again, you want to build Gaza back, it's without Hamas. It cannot be with Hamas. You want to do what you can live, you can work for it, but you can't. No one will give them the funds to do that. And this is the only way I believe they will maybe change their way of thinking. But again, it's all about force. It's all about honor. When you look now what's happening in Syria and the way the people there act and how they kill each other without a blink of an eye, the Western world doesn't understand that at all. The Western world, you know, is quite naive about this problem with the rising of the extreme Islam. And as long as it doesn't knock on your door, you feel safe. You say, it's okay. But one day it knocks on your door. And for us, it's been knocking on the door for 77 years now. And we know exactly what we're dealing with. Also, the people of the kibbutzim near Gaza, which were murdered and kidnapped on the 7th of October, these people were most pro-Gaza in the world. They were helping them, and they were giving them aid and teaching them and driving them to the Israeli hospitals and whatever, and then they come back and they kill them, and they rape them and they murder them. So this is what we're dealing with. What can we do? It's our destiny to fight Gaza for many, many years to come, and as long as we understand that, we haven't got much of a choice.
You said something earlier that is so disappointing. You know, I like to deal in reality, right? And I think this, and I always divide things up into unpleasant truths and comforting lies. And, you know, there are a lot of unpleasant truths here that we have to deal with. But when the truth doesn't matter anymore, and I think you're spot on when you said that, you know, we're moving these things in directions that, potentially, I don't know that we ever recover from. I don't know that Israel ever recovers, or Gaza, or the Palestinians ever recover from.
I think, you know, Israel, I think you're right. It's kind of frustrating. But once you understand that, and you say, okay, this is something, like, you know, a person wakes up in the morning, and he goes to the doctor, and he finds out he has cancer, and now he has to fight it. It's a new reality which you have to face. It's not pleasant, but if you will imagine that, no, it will go away tomorrow and you wake up, it doesn't help usually. So you have to pull yourself together and get a good government and a good leadership. And there are very good people here and very talented people. And eventually, once we get this government out of the way, I believe we will start climbing out of this situation. If we don't, then we're doomed.
Yeah. Well, I always thought the easiest way is that the international community would coalesce and they would try to checkmate the UN and do the right thing, deal with the truth of the matter, resolve it. But it feels like we're going in the opposite direction.
You're going in the opposite direction because, you know, it's not politically correct to say that the so-called weaker side, the poor people of Gaza, they can't be wrong because they're suffering so much. They can't be wrong. You have to pity them and you have to help them. Now, I don't say you don't have to help them, but you have to put it in proportion. You have to put it for a cost. You have to put it in a way that they know they have to change their ways. The Palestinian people of Gaza, and some of them in the West Bank, they never supported themselves as a nation. They always got money from the outside, from the Arabs, from the richer Arab countries, from Europe, from Israel, from wherever. They did not support themselves as a nation. But they always cry that everybody else is to blame, and they are the poor side of the equation. That's if they're poor side. it's like when you have a little brother who disturbs you and bothers you and, I don't know, gives you hell, and once you give him a smack, he runs to his mother and you're to blame. And that's life.
Well, but when your primary motivation is retaliation, getting even, and, you know, we're going to show them kind of point of life, and that's their reality. You get all this money and you build tunnels. You don't feed your own people. You don't promote an economy. You don't advance education. You're building tunnels and buying guns. I mean, that speaks volumes.
That's why I think. Look, what happened now in Gaza, and also in Lebanon, and also in Syria, and also in Iran, but mainly in Gaza, the amount of retaliation which Israel poured on them in destruction. And is unbelievable. And this is the language they understand. You know, they get up every morning and they sleep in a tent. And if they're lucky to have a tent, and they get up the next morning and they go beg for food. This is something I don't think they'll forget. But I think the world has to also recognize that it's not only retaliation, it's something which must be followed by a culture change and a governing change. You know, when Gaza was handed over to in 2005 to the Palestinians, there were plans to build Gaza and make it into the next Singapore, and everybody was willing to invest money in there, et cetera, et cetera. And look what happened to them.
Yeah.
It's their fault.
It's going to be interesting. I pray for you guys every day, Colonel.
Thank you.
You know, I know. It's absolutely mystifying to me where this is headed most recently. It's frustrating. And I can't even imagine what it's like for you guys. But thank you so much for joining us and sharing your story.
Thank you very much for your support and for having me and giving the chance to explain to you what you're doing for us and what's happening over here. So good evening, and thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Stay safe. That's Colonel Alex Gann, retired colonel and fighter pilot for the Israeli Air Force, now living in a small village in northern Israel. We will be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Open Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. Folks, just as a reminder, as we get into the heart of the hurricane season, everybody worries about losing power. WWL wants to help ease your concerns. That's why we've teamed up with Craig's Electrical and Generator Service to offer you the chance to win a portable generator. We're talking about a Generac GP6500 portable generator. Total value almost $1,000. Go to WWL.com/contest for your chance to win backup power from Craig's Electrical and Generator Service, because when the power goes off, Craig comes on, and WWL Louisiana official emergency management station. And this will run through Sunday, August the 3rd. So you have a couple more days to get your opportunity in to win this generator. I've seen this GP6500. It's a neat unit, really is. Works well, and it's something that you want to consider getting. All right, folks, after the top of the hour news break, when we return, we are going to visit with Freddie King, New Orleans City Council member. We're going to talk about the difficulties that some of our ABO outlets are having relative to ABO licensing. And the fines and penalties can get up as high as one bar, Plume, a tiny little Indian restaurant in Algiers, they owe $4,800 in fines. They didn't realize that their license had lapsed in many cases. And we need to figure out a better way to notify folks that the license has expired, right? So we'll talk to Freddie King and see what they're thinking about. And in the back half of the 11 o'clock hour, J.P. Morrell, the council member at large. He's also the president of the council. Yes, we will be talking trash. Again, we'll try and figure out exactly where we are. The mayor made some moves yesterday. Sounds like they were productive in moving forward on this front. We'll find out for sure when we visit with Councilmember J.P. Morrell. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Newell on WWL.